So this morning's first speaker will be Igor Klebanov of Princeton, who will make remarks on gravity duals of n equals 1 supersymmetric gauge theories.
Thank you. So this talk is meant mainly as a review of some results with a bit of new stuff added. And as you all know, there has been much interest in warped backgrounds of string theory. Amanda? Okay, so by warped backgrounds, we mean a generalization of ordinary compactifications where in front of the four-dimensional metric, you have some factor depending on the transverse coordinates. And these backgrounds arise in both gauge theory, gravity duality, and also in some recent new scenarios for string phenomenology. So as we all know, for example, the metric of ADS 5 crosses 5 has this structure. It has a warp factor R squared over L squared in front of the 3 plus 1 dimensional metric. And then the transverse space is a warped R6. So in this case, as we all know, the warping is due to n units of Ramon-Ramon 5 form flux. So one thing that appears to be a rather general fact is that pure NSNS fields do not produce a warp metric in the string frame. Now, why is that? Well, first of all, if you look at any NSNS stabilized solution, you can sort of, for example, the NS5 brain, it's true. Other solutions, it's true. And a simple argument, as Arkady Zeitlin told me yesterday, is simply to look at the string sigma model, which is available in the NSNS formulation. And then all the fields are not allowed to depend on the longitudinal coordinates x0 through x3. So the model just factorizes with these coordinates just being free fields on the world sheet. Hence, you will get no warp factor in the NSNS case. Therefore, it appears absolutely crucial from the point of view of string compactifications to have Ramon-Ramon field strengths turned on. And that, of course, generally brings out the connection with gauge theories because we know that Ramon-Ramon fluxes come from D-brains, and D-brains are places where gauge theories live. So it gives this rather general way of connecting the two. And perhaps one of the major discoveries of the last few years is that the number of Ramon-Ramon flux quanta has to be identified with some particular number of colors in the dual gauge theory. It's a wonderful fact which is not completely proven, but there are many examples of this, and I'll talk about some examples today. And moreover, this warp factor is proportional to the energy scale of the dual theory. So this relation between the warping and the energy scale gives a kind of new possibility for explaining the large ratio of M Planck and the TV energy scale. Basically, what you want are models where there is large but bounded variation of log omega throughout space. And these are models which were considered by Randall Sundrum, then in a more stringy setting by Hermann Verlinde, and most recently the really stabilized hierarchy was shown by Giddings, Kutcher, and Polchinski. So these types of models can perhaps be used to not only consider dual gauge theories at low energy, but also to incorporate quantum gravity into the game. Now, there are different types of infrared behavior. So we know that in the infrared, this warp factor omega has to become small, so it basically decreases towards the infrared. If this warp factor goes to zero in such a way that the metric becomes a product of ADS5 and some Einstein space, then we know that from the ADS-CFT correspondence that the gauge theory then flows to a conformal point in the infrared. If the warp factor approaches some finite constant, then the dual theory confines. You can show this by computing Wilson loop expectation values. But as we all know, in practice, when you solve supergravity equations, it often gives neither of these two things. On the contrary, omega squared just blows up at some point in the infrared, and this creates a naked singularity. And I'll show one example of this in a couple minutes. Now, I think this is basically unacceptable, and one has to regulate the singularity. So by now, there are a couple of different ways of regulating the singularity which apply to different theories. For example, one can have a specifically stringy resolution as considered by Polchinski and Strassler based on the Myers effect. In this case, what happens is that some five brains inflate and appear before the metric singularity is reached. So basically, the region behind this inflated brains is just not trustworthy, and the metric changes drastically there. And this resolution applies to the n equal 1 star theory, which is n equal 4 theory perturbed by mass terms. Okay, so this has been explored quite a bit. But it turns out that one can have not something fancy like this, but just a simple supergravity resolution of such naked singularity. And the idea here is that perhaps the solution that produces this naked singularity is just not the most general ansatz consistent with the symmetries that we know to exist. One can have, for example, consider a more general ansatz which produces a non-singular space where the warp factor, instead of blowing up, just approaches a finite constant in the infrared. And examples of this were found by Matt Strassler and me, and by Maldacena and Nunez. This applies to theories whose UV behavior is either the Seiberg duality cascade, which was our paper, or the six-dimensional little string theory, which was the Maldacena-Nunez paper. So we have some zoo of examples of resolutions of singularity, but we're still missing some general understanding of why some theories require a stringy resolution, other theories have supergravity resolution. Perhaps there are other approaches to these singularities that we don't know yet. So there is really no systematic understanding. And one question that I think should be addressed is just how do you, by looking at a given field theory, tell whether it's going to be resolved supergravity-wise or something more fancy needs to be done. Okay, so another thing that we learned recently is that when you actually resolve the singularity, this involves some breaking of the original symmetry present in the singular solution. So the singular solution typically has too much symmetry, some unacceptable amount of symmetry. So resolution of singularity explains some symmetry breaking in the dual gauge theory. For example, in all these three examples I mentioned, far in the infrared, we find n equal 1 supersymmetric 4D gauge theory. Since we know well that this theory exhibits both chiral symmetry breaking and confinement, we find that indeed resolution of this naked singularity breaks the relevant chiral symmetry. And this was shown in these three papers and also in a somewhat different point of view using superpotentials by Kumru and Wafa. Okay, so let me discuss this example that Matt Strassler and I considered, which has a rather peculiar UV behavior, which we call the duality cascade. So in this theory, we not only learn something interesting in the infrared, we also have some rather surprising new type of behavior in the UV. So the idea is that you first start with a n equal 1 supersymmetric example of ADS CFT correspondence, which comes from ND3 brains on the Carney fold. So any time you have a cone and you place D3 brains on it, in the near horizon region, you'll find ADS 5 times the base of this cone. In the case of the Carney fold, the base of the cone is a certain coset space T11. And again, you'll find n units of Ramon-Ramon 5-form flux through this T11, which produces the necessary warping to have the ADS 5 in the infrared. And this theory is simply dual to the theory on ND3 brains at this Carney fold singularity, which can be shown to be SUN cross SUN, coupled to chiral superfields A1 and A2 in this bifundamental representation, and B1 and B2 in this bifundamental representation. And you find that it's necessary to include an exactly marginal superpotential, which is quartic. So because it's quartic, these fields acquire some exact anomalous dimensions. So this theory is conformal, and to create a duality cascade, it turns out that you need to add, in addition to these ND3 brains, you need to add MD5 brains wrapped over the S2 of T11. So the interesting thing about T11 is that topologically it's a product of S2 cross S3. So we can just take this S2 and wrap it by MD5 brains, so that we still have a 3+1 dimensional longitudinal space, but now it becomes warped in a different way because of the presence of these extra D5 brains. Then this theory changes to SUN plus M cross SUN, and it also gives you a clue that to implement the supergravity dual of this non-conformal now gauge theory, one has to add M units of D5 brain flux, which is just the Ramon-Ramon 3-form flux, to n units of the D3 brain flux, which we had before. And the nice thing is that this can be shown to produce the logarithmic flow of couplings that you expect to see on the field theory side. So the metric of T11 can be written in an explicit way, and you have these Fani coefficients, 1/9 and 1/6 here. And what we'll see in a second is that this 1/9 actually turns into a correct factor of 3 in the beta function for the flow in this theory. So we'll find some connection between these geometrical quantities in the metric and beta functions in the gauge theory. And also note that this angle psi varies from 0 to 4 pi, while phi 1, phi 2, and theta 1, theta 2 label two spheres. So this metric can be thought of as a U1 bundle over a product of two spheres. Now one can write down explicitly the harmonic 2 and 3 forms. So the harmonic 2 form is the difference of the volume forms of the two S2s, and the harmonic 3 form can be just written also explicitly as E psi wedge this 2 form, and normalize them as follows. So I'm being careful here about normalizations because I'm going to claim that there is an exact correspondence between what we see in the supergravity solution and the field theory beta functions. Now, the normalization condition for the Ramon-Ramon flux is that 1 over 4 pi squared alpha prime times the integral of F3 over the 3 cycle is equal to M. So now you can actually write down an exact solution with this flux through the Carney fold. And this was done by Arkady Tsetlin and myself. And it has the following fields. So F3, to be normalized properly, has this factor times M omega 3. And then B2 has this extra factor of 3 times log. So this log means that there is some logarithmic flow of couplings, because the integral of B2 through the 2 cycle is just the difference of inverse couplings of the two gauge groups. And the factor of 3 here is necessary because so when you turn it into H3, you have to require that H3 and F3 are self-dual. They're dual to each other, okay? So in particular, H3 squared has to be equal to F3 squared. And now we remember this relative 1/9 in the metric, which sits in front of deep psi plus. So the reason this three appears is because there is this one ninth in the metric. Okay, seemingly a. You know, from the metric point of view, it seemed like a fact of dubious significance, but we'll see that it is significant. So, and the dilatant turns out to be exactly zero. So you get, again, a warp product of R3, 1 and the conical space, except the warp factor, instead of just being 1 over R to the 4, acquires an extra logarithmic term. Okay? And here, again, I was careful about the coefficients. So the five-form field, so as we know, basically the warp factor is some, essentially the effective number of three brains at a given scale divided by R to the 4. And indeed, you can write the five-form field as some n of R times the volume form of T11. And there is, again, this logarithmic extra term, 3 over 2 pi g string m squared log R of R naught. Okay, so what we see is that somehow the number of colors n in this SUN cross SUN plus m theory has become scale dependent, and every time the log decreases by 2 pi over 3 g string m, you get n decreasing by m units. And I have to say that this precisely agrees with a slightly different way of normalizing things that was done by Giddings, Kutcher, and Polchinski. Okay. So this was interpreted by Matt Strassler and me as cascade of Seiberg dualities. So just to see how this works, let's look at the these NSVZ beta functions for this theory. The fields trace AB acquire some anomalous dimension gamma. So if you just write down these beta functions, you have some mismatch of each beta function. If you take the difference between this coupling and this coupling, you find exactly 6m times log lambda over mu up to some small m over n corrections. So far in the, what we see is that far in the UV, n is going to become effectively very large. So there might be small corrections to this, but apart from that, it's exact. Okay, and now we can just compare it with what we see in the supergravity. We know that the integral of B2 is given by this expression, 2 pi alpha prime times 3 g string m times the log. And then we use the relation between the integral of B2 and the inverse couplings, which is valid both in the Z2 orbifold model and in this T11 model. And we find exact agreement with this field theory result here. Okay, so as I said, the big deal was this factor of 3, which seems to have been given this nice geometrical interpretation. And there is another way to compute the beta function, which was done by Kumru and Wafa by analyzing the superpotential. It doesn't seem to directly refer to the metric, but it gives the same result, I believe, from computing the superpotential through the integral of the complex 3-4 wedge, the Calabi-Yau 3-0 form. Okay, so it seems like we made some progress in explaining logarithmic flow in the gauge theory. So now coming back to these results, we see that every time there is a cascade step, this R over R naught changes by a factor e to the minus 2 pi over 3 g string m. And this was a result first carefully normalized by Giddings et al. So after k cascade steps, you can create a pretty large ratio of R to R naught. But then we know that R, up to some logarithms, R is the warp factor. Okay, because in fact, the warp factor is not quite R. It has some factor of square root of the log, but that very slowly. So if you only care about exponential terms, this indeed gives you the hierarchy. And the nice thing is that it can be made exponentially large. Okay, so the other extra ingredient in stabilizing the hierarchy is that, of course, In the KT solution, there are two problems. One is that the cascade goes on forever in the UV. Nothing stops it. And then there is a naked singularity in the infrared where the warp factor hits zero. Now, both of these problems can be solved. So in stopping the cascade in the UV, that's done by considering some F-theory compactification on Calabi-Yau fourfold. Then you can say stop the cascade at R of order R-naught, which simply corresponds to the Planck scale where the gauge theory couples to gravity. And at this scale, you can generate a pretty large effective number of colors, not by putting brains there explicitly, but simply through this cascade mechanism. So this effective number of colors at scale R-naught and naught can be made quite large, say 72 in the example in their paper. And then if this N-naught is a multiple of M, then you know that after K cascade steps, the theory will just cascade down to pure SUM in the infrared, and the cascade should stop there. So we should have, so if this is true, then only K cascade steps should be allowed, and you should be able to generate precisely this hierarchy. But how do you see this from the solution? Well, I'm sure you already know the answer. So to see this in the solution, one has to incorporate the phenomenon of chiral symmetry breaking into the geometry. And this is done by replacing the conifold by the deformed conifold. So the conifold is given by this equation, and the deformation is accomplished by adding epsilon squared on the right-hand side. Then, very nicely, the metric can still be determined explicitly. It's now a warp product of R3, 1, and the deformed conifold, which is a Calabi-Yau space whose metric is known exactly, and it can be written explicitly in terms of these angular forms here. So the thing to observe about these forms, G1, G2, G3, G4, is that while the previous metric had absolutely no psi dependence, this one does, okay? And to see this psi dependence explicitly, we just note that these forms E1, E2, E3, E4 have an explicit cosine psi and sine psi in them. The 3 form can be also determined explicitly, and it turns out to be a 2,1 harmonic form, which ensures the supersymmetry of the model. So you see that, so the one important observation is that these cosine, these functions appeared, and they're symmetric under shift of psi by 2 pi. But if you remember, the original convention was that psi changes from 0 to 4 pi. So this metric still has a residual Z2 symmetry under this 2 pi rotation. And for large tau, it matches on to this previous cascading asymptotic. Namely, the warp factor wasn't just 1 over R to the 4. It had an extra factor of the logarithm, which tells us that the number of colors is growing logarithmically. But now the really good news is that for small tau, this H stabilizes at some finite quantity of order G string M squared, which explains that the theory has become confining as it should. So this metric has both breaking so now this psi rotation symmetry is interpreted as the chiral symmetry, and it's been broken down to Z2. So now another comment is what is the chiral symmetry in the UV? This is sort of a subtle point because the UV metric has a precise U1 symmetry, right? It was completely psi independent. However, it doesn't mean that the theory in the UV has U1 symmetry. This is because if you actually look at this Ramon-Ramon two-form field, it's topologically non-trivial, right? Because F3 is proportional to this harmonic form omega 3. So C2 cannot really be written locally, okay? In a non-singular, can be written only locally. There is no global non-singular expression. So you basically find that C2 is not invariant under arbitrary shifts of psi. And this is just a sign that there is no U1 symmetry, In fact, when you look closely, there is only Z2M unbroken symmetry in the UV. So the pattern of chiral symmetry, and I'll show this more precisely in a second. So the pattern of symmetry breaking is from Z2M to Z2. Therefore, there should be M in equivalent vacuum. And the domain wall, which takes us from one vacuum to the other, is just a D5 brain wrapped over a finite S3 near tau equals zero. Okay? So let's look that indeed this domain wall precisely does the job. Here I've written this finite S3 that remains at tau equals zero. And then there is a non-compact, so this is the A cycle. And then there is a dual non-compact B cycle, which consists of tau and the expanding S2. So it looks sort of like a cigar. Now, what we should have is, after we've wrapped the D5 brain, crossing this domain wall should create some integral of F3 through this B cycle. So before we crossed it, there was no, this integral was zero. After we crossed it, it should be one unit of flux, which is 4 pi squared flux, which is 4 pi squared alpha prime. But now, just integrating this, this can be pushed to the boundary. So this is just the integral over S2 at infinity of C2. But this integral at infinity, so this is basically what determines things in the UV. So this extra bit of C2 that we have generated turns out to be pi alpha prime times omega 2. So it's proportional to this S2 volume form. But now, if the C2 that was originally present due to the m units of flux can be locally written in this form, right? Because its derivative is d psi wedge omega 2. So what we see is that upon crossing, the effect of crossing the domain wall is to replace this by this plus this, which effectively shifts psi by 2 pi over m. And that's precisely the right shift to generate m vacuum. So the stringy way to go from one vacuum to the other is to put in this wrapped D5 brain. And this indeed produces only m different orientations of the solution and not some continuum of orientations. So this indeed explains, I think, the whole story. And the other interesting thing is that because this cascade is not exactly a conformal theory, but it's kind of close to being conformal, and this allows ADS-CFT techniques to be applied, for example, to calculations of expectation values. So in the usual ADS background, if we have some field turned on, which falls off, say, as 1 over r cubed at large r, it corresponds to adding an expectation value to a dimension 3 operator. Okay, and this trick can be applied here, and it basically works. This was done by Levy and Sonnenschein. What you can do is you can basically calculate what perturbation this non-symmetric solution creates around the asymptotic KT form. Okay, this is a very simple calculation because you know the exact form of both B2 and C2. You find that this perturbation behaves as e to the minus tau times tau over 2 times e to the minus I psi times some angular 2 form. Now, tau e to the minus tau is just log r over r cubed. So up to logarithmic correction, this indeed corresponds to the expectation value of a dimension 3 operator. And moreover, it has exactly the right R charge to correspond to the Gluyena condensate. Namely, under psi going to psi plus 2 pi over m, it rotates as Gluyena condensate should. And this is an SU2 cross SU2 singlet, which means that this has nothing to do with the fermions A and B. Okay, fermions corresponding to these A and B fields. Those have disappeared by the time we get to the infrared. So this is really has all the criteria to correspond to the Gluyena condensate, and you can probably even normalize it. So this shows how the solution carries Gluyena condensate holographically. Now, just some comment about the domain wall in the domain wall in the compact model. So in the compact model, what happens is that instead of this non-compact B cycle, it just becomes compact. So before you cross the domain wall, you have some flux of H3 through the B cycle and flux of F3 through the A cycle. So it's given by these expressions. But now, after you've wrapped the domain wall over the A cycle, we find some additional contribution to F3, which corresponds to the volume form of the B cycle. And the reason this domain wall is allowed is that such a domain wall creates no discontinuity in the integral of H3 wedge of 3, right? This is the quantity that is basically fixed by the topology of the compactification, and we don't want the domain wall to screw it up, okay? So therefore, this is an acceptable domain wall. But for example, taking the NS5 brain and wrapping it over the A cycle would not be an acceptable domain wall because it would change this value. So what you can do is wrap it around the B cycle, and I'm not sure exactly what the interpretation of it is. Maybe this domain wall doesn't exist because it has some enormous back reaction on the geometry. But at least even in this compact model, the original domain walls corresponding to M in equivalent vacua still exist. Okay, so now just a few words about some work in progress. So we learned that this cascade is a kind of new way of generating some number of brains without having them explicitly there, basically replacing brain generation through some special fluxes through dual cycles, both Ramon-Ramon and then SNS. And one question that one might want to ask is how can one lift this cascade phenomenon to the M-theory setting? For example, can it be described by these G2 holonomy compactifications? And I think the tentative answer I'll give is no. But let us just try to do this. And now there are various ways to lift type 2 solutions to M theory. It's, for example, as a warm-up, let me consider the type 2B Maldacena-Nunez solution, which just describes N and SNS5 brains wrapped over S2. This solution doesn't have a cascade. It simply has the NS5 brain asymptotics as a linear dilaton. And so this solution is particularly easy to lift because it's a purely NS solution. It can be just lifted to a wrapped M5 brain. Okay. So let me do this in detail. You have this type 2B metric. One obvious thing you can do is first t-dualize along these X4 directions, along the longitudinal, say, 1, 2, or 3 directions. This is a trivial operation on the solution. So you simply go to exactly the same type of background but in type 2A theory. But that we know exactly how to lift. Okay, and and we get the 11-dimensional metric, which has the same form as we're used to seeing. And it has some G4. So it's not going to be a G2 holonomy compactification because it has some four-form field strength turned on. But now let me do something crazy. Okay, so this was all perfectly justified and non-controversial. Let me derive essentially the same result in a somewhat strange way. So first, I can take these NSNS type 2B brains and S-dualize them to D5 brains. Okay, that's non-controversial. Then we can apply formal T-duality along the psi direction. And remember that psi is this U1 fiber over S2 cross S2. So when you do that, you obtain a rather peculiar type 2A background. Okay. So what it did to the solution is it somehow changed the topology of the space from S2 cross S3 to S2 cross S2 cross S1. And this has, this t-duality turned the three-form field strength into a two-form field strength. So there will be this RR potential C1, and there will be some H3. Then you can take this solution and lift it to M theory. Okay? And then something interesting happens, that basically because of the presence of this C1, the X11 coordinate starts being what psi coordinate used to be. It becomes somehow non-trivially fibered over S2 cross S2. And as the end result, after you've done this, you get basically the same solution that you obtained in this well-justified way, except for some redefinitions and projections. So for one thing, X11 and psi got interchanged, and secondly, there is a Zn orbifold acting on psi, right? Because there is this factor of n that appears. So it's not quite the same solution, but it becomes literally the same when you formally set n equal to 1. Okay. So the reason I did this for this Maldacena-Nunez solution is that I showed to you that the second procedure, which you might question, actually makes some amount of sense and gives a sensible end result. Now, let's do it to the cascading solution. Then the first method simply does not work because you have some additional fields and they screw up the ability to, you cannot just go to the purely NS object, t-dualize it and lift it. But we can do the second thing. And if we do it, we get a pretty amusing result. So this is, as I said, work with Arkady Zeitlin and Leo Pandazias. So as a first step, when we go to type 2a, we again seem to screw up the topology. Okay, we somehow T11 becomes S1 cross S2 cross S2, but we pick up again m units of this two-form flux, and we also get additional fields, F4, H3, so you have more fields around. But then when you lift this solution to M theory, again, you sort of get back to the more or less original topology cross S1. So after we lift it, you get now a metric with X11 fibered over these two S2s and an extra angle. Okay, so this... So then the angular space is basically T11 mod Zm times this S1 angle psi. And you get a pretty interesting looking solution in 11 dimensions, which has logarithms in front of various factors. So it differs from ADS 5 cross something only by logarithmic terms. So it's a pretty peculiar background of M theory. And it incorporates the logarithmic running. Now, it's not, again, it's not simply a G2 holonomy space, so our conjecture is to see this cascading. You can't just limit yourself to G2 holonomy. You also have to turn on G4 in a rather special way. But the question about this solution is similar to the original question we had with Arkady when we wrote down the singular logarithmic solution in type 2b. Is there a continuation of it to the infrared which regulates it? And to this, we don't know the answer yet, but we believe that the solution is acceptable in the UV, and correspondingly, we should be able to regulate it. So this is the question that I want to end the talk with. So now the speculative part. I heard complaints yesterday that people are refusing to really speculate, and I know the feeling, because when you stand here with a microphone and you are being broadcast to the entire world, it's difficult. Maybe if, you know, you give me a couple of drinks, turn off the mic, then I would tell you what I really think about this field and where it's going. So I'll try not to do this here, but predicting the future is very, very difficult. I mean, sometimes even safe predictions don't come true. For example, when I was growing up, I heard every day that we were steadily marching towards communism. So it seemed, at the time, it seemed like an incredibly safe prediction. So instead, I will I'll be conservative, and I'll just limit myself to questions which are kind of immediate continuation of the questions that came up in the talk. So what we saw is that there is a rather precise matching between logarithms in this cascading theory and logarithms you see in the field theory. And moreover, the solution basically exhibits dimensional transmutation. Namely, once you choose the scale of the log, it's related to the physical scale and then translates into the Gluina condensation and so on. But this is a rather strange theory. It's not asymptotically free, right? It manages to flow in such a way that both couplings are strong. So the really $64,000 question in this field is it possible somehow to exhibit asymptotic freedom of some theory, of course preferably QCD, in the closed string language? It's probably a very, very difficult question. I mean, there were some attempts made. I mean, this question was, Sasha Polyakov keeps asking it every time I talk to him, both in his work and in papers by Joe Minahan and Arkady and myself. We tried to at least construct some approximate models in type zero theory where you see some logarithmic flows in the UV, but these results are not terribly reliable. So I think it would be really nice to, even if the model is not truly reliable, to see something like this happening, because I think this is the key to a complete solution of the theory through closed strings. So if we are to really solve the theory using the closed string language, that's a must. Another point of view might be that this is just too hard, and we have to somehow match together two different descriptions of the theory. So what we've been having a fairly easy time doing is seeing how confinement could come about in the infrared. So up to some intermediate scale, you could use closed string language and then match it somehow to the field theoretic flow where asymptotic freedom is no trouble to see. Okay, so if that's the case, then I'm not sure this would constitute dramatic progress in understanding of the gauge theory. I think it would be really desirable to see this happen. So this is question one. The other question which often comes up, I mean, I'm sorry for these rather banal questions. The trouble with our field is that everyone knows the important questions, but no one knows the answers. And we know that to get answers to them, it has to be some sort of serendipity. There is no particular systematic way to approach them. But one other question that often comes up is how does string theory coexist with absence of space-time supersymmetry? I mean, it's often said that supersymmetry is almost a prediction of string theory, but if there is a string theory of QCD, there has to be a perfectly sensible string theory without supersymmetry. And at the moment, it looks like, at best, a very uneasy alliance. And one thing that you see when you attempt to remove space-time supersymmetry from the beginning is that you get tachyons in the closed string sector, and you have to do something about them. So you can either contemplate some sort of closed string tachyon condensation, this was again a question asked a few times already. We've learned a tremendous amount about open string tachyon condensation, but closed string tachyon condensation is probably far more challenging and has some new phenomena in it. Or you can maybe stabilize the tachyon and just say that for some regime of parameters it stops being tachyonic. So these are the two possibilities, but the other question is, if you look at this non-supersymmetric gauge gravity duality, what is the meaning of the tachyon field to begin with? Okay, it appears to be a field which corresponds to scale-dependent vacuum energy or something like that. And usually in our treatments of field theory, we simply ignore the vacuum energy. So maybe what these perhaps naive formulations such as the type zero string theory are telling us is that to really understand the dynamics of non-supersymmetric gauge theories, one should include the vacuum energy, include its scale dependence, and that's somehow encoded in the tachyon field varying as a function of the radius in these dual backgrounds. So these are the rather modest set of questions, but I'm sure all of us will be extremely happy if we make some progress along these lines. So thank you.
Questions?
So I guess the reason you can't just lift the non-singular solution that you and Strassler found to 11 dimensions is that you don't have symmetry in the psi direction anymore.
Right. We don't even have it formally.
Right.
I mean, it's a formal t-duality that we're using. But for that, you know, so that's the reason.
I was just wondering, I mean, I don't understand this very well, but I know that there are cases that where you can, well, I mean, Yao and Andy and people argued that you could view mirror symmetry as a type of t-duality in a Calabi-Yau mm-hmm. space even when you don't have continuous symmetries. So I was wondering if there might be some way of using those ideas to construct a lift.
Yeah, I think that's probably what we need, but I don't know at the moment how to translate it into a specific solution. Actually, is it known how mirror symmetry acts on these supergravity solutions? Right. Yeah, certainly topologically we know what should happen, but on the level of the full metric, I don't think we know. And this is sort of an attempt to do it, I think.
Any questions? Okay, let's thank you.